I'm Ben Sawyer, and this is The Road to Now. Today's episode is a conversation with John Fea. He's professor of American history at Messiah College, and in this conversation, Bob spoke with him about his book, Was America Founded as a Christian Nation? It came out in 2011. This conversation, it originally aired as Road to Now Theology number 2 in 2018, but it is so important right now. John came on last year to talk about the 1776 Commission, this attempt to create a, quote, patriotic history. The institution that was primarily behind that, Hillsdale College, has recently emerged as pretty important in my own state of Tennessee, where our Governor Bill Lee has recently announced that he will be partnering with them to produce new textbooks for our public charter schools. Bob and I plan to talk more about this on upcoming episodes, but for now, I feel like this episode, this conversation with John Fea, is a really good place to start in trying to wrap your head around the issues that come from trying to impose an ideological view over history. One of the things I love about John Fea is he's a great scholar, and he himself is an evangelical Christian. He spent time with the documents. He finds no conflict between a rigorous reading of history and his own faith. And that, to me, is really the way it should go. I've never understood why people feel like if they don't tell a story to someone, make sure that they hear it over and over again, that somehow that story won't work. People are smart. And the problem becomes that if you tell people a story that doesn't quite correspond with the way things were, I mean, from your perspective, you should be worried about losing them, honestly, once they get a little bit outside of there and read the truth and go into the documents. But from the other hand, to me, it's scary because this country is all of ours. It doesn't belong to any one person. And if it belongs to all of us, then a story needs to be one that we can all see ourselves in and understand ourselves in. And right now, with so much division in the country that we're seeing, I just can't help but feel like the idea of giving one narrative to a group of people and making that separate from another narrative that people are getting, or just to have one that is given to people who may never get a chance to see outside of that because they're working hard in their lives and don't have a chance to sit down and read all these books, it's going to create conflict. It's divisive. The reason I want to share this episode today again is because John Fea shows that it doesn't have to be that way. He shows that with his work and this conversation that Bob had with him, which is actually where I got to know who John Fea was and turned to his work. And now I can say that I myself in my classroom, the way that I teach the Constitution is so informed by his work because I had reached the conclusions from what I had read. But seeing someone as intelligent as John and someone as thoughtful as him, digging deeper into the sources and making a compelling argument like this, this is a great book. And this conversation will give you a lot of what's there. So please, guys, enjoy this. And I want to say this as well. This was a part of Road to Now earlier, the RTN Theology. Bob and Chris Breslin, they started making a lot of new episodes, and we actually set up a separate feed for them. The episodes they recorded, they cover a lot more than just history. They cover culture and music, but it's all still there. If you want to check it out, look up RTN Theology. One last thing to explain here. This episode, I'm going to number Road to Now, episode number 222. I realize that it is an older conversation. I'm only doing that because the Road to Now Theologies aren't on our feed anymore. And also, I want to make sure this is searchable. And also, because we use the Bitly link shortener, and it's really easy to go when you have the number, because you just go rtnpod.me/, and then the number. It'll take you right to the episode. I think this one deserves its own Bitly, because I think you guys might be sharing it, right? Please do. And thank you guys, everyone on Patreon, everyone who's shared our podcast, all of you guys who have rated us on iTunes, or it's not iTunes anymore, it's Apple Podcasts. All you guys who rated us before like 2016. Anyway, Apple Podcasts, anything like that, it means a lot. And we'll be back with a new episode next week. So see you then.
Our guest today is John Fea. He's the author of Was America Founded as a Christian Nation? A Historical Introduction. He's a professor of American history and the chair of the history department at Messiah College in Grantham, Pennsylvania, where he's taught since 2002. His forthcoming book, Believe Me, The Evangelical Road to Donald Trump, will be available on June 30th, 2018. He's also the host of the podcast and blog, The Way of Improvement Leads Home. And I'm so grateful to have him as my guest today on RTN Theology. John Fea, welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be on the show. Thanks for having me.
Well, this could be the shortest show we've ever done because there's really one question here. Was America founded as a Christian nation?
It's a question I've been asked almost every interview I do for the last 6-7 years. In some ways, that's the first question that's asked. It's a complicated question. And my book that I wrote on this in 2011, and it actually has come out in the second edition last year, is really examining this question from a historical perspective. So the subtitle of the book is An Historical Introduction. So I'm not particularly interested in the book in the question of whether we are a Christian nation today or, you know, the contemporary politics surrounding this. I'm much more interested in what the founding fathers believed about the relationship between Christianity and the American founding. So in some ways, and I often say this, in some ways, the title of my book, Was America Founded as a Christian Nation, is in some ways a bad historical title. And what I mean by that is, actually, the original title was probably something boring, like, I can't remember now, something like Religion and the American Founding or something. And my editors at Westminster John Knox Press said, we need something a little sexier, a little, you know, it's going to catch the attention a little bit more. So what we ended up doing is we ended up taking a debate, a question that's been debated probably in a serious, it's been debated since the like 1970s, really, in a serious way in our so-called culture wars, and kind of superimposed that. The title kind of suggests that we're superimposing that back on the 18th century when many of the founders were not debating this point. So the question, was America founded as a Christian nation, is very much a modern question. And it's not a question the founders were asking. So it's complicated and it's complex. But when you think about it historically, you know, I try to teach my students history is very complex and it often doesn't conform to the kind of boxes we want to put it in the present.
And I looked at it as kind of tongue in cheek, right? You know, like really we all know, everyone who listens to this show knows how complex that question is and how fraught with confusion it is and how it's like, and you kind of say this early in the book, like if you know how you feel, like most of the time you'll go out and give a talk and people already know how they feel about the answer. They already have the answer that they believe. And so you challenge us, to, what do you say? History is risk and willingness. Did I quote that correctly?
I think risk and wisdom.
Risk and wisdom. You're trying to get us out of our comfort zones. What I love about this, I read a lot of history books. You got to love a history book that starts out with a primer about what historians do.
So
tell us about the five C's.
Yeah, sure. Again, a little bit of this kind of history behind the history of this, my writing on this, you know, one of the things is I went around and I spoke and did radio interviews and podcast interviews about Was America Founded as a Christian Nation, the book. One of the things that I noticed was in some ways, yes, there was the politicization of the past. You know, we were taking our political agendas in the present. I think both the left and the right do this at times and superimposing them on the past. But at the heart of kind of this was not necessarily as much as sort of, you know, what the founders believed about religion and Christianity and so on, because you could pull out quotes. You could find the founders saying that, you know, Christianity is important to the good of the republic. You could also pull out quotes from founding fathers who say that Christianity is a false religion, or they don't believe in the sort of core essential doctrines of the Christian faith. So to me, what I was, as I began to sort of think more deeply about this, really there was a problem here about in our culture, I think, and especially among some Christians, but generally about how to think historically, right? How does the past relate to the present? And I felt like a lot of even political pundits and people you see on cable news and so forth were kind of ill-informed about how this works. So I wrote a second book, a book right after this called Why Study History, in which I kind of tried to unpack this. And in both, in that book, and I think in the Christian America book as well, I borrowed from these historians who said that at the key to this kind of historical thinking, the kind of thinking that is absolutely essential for living together in a democratic life and understanding the relationships between the past and the present, are these five C's. And they are, the idea that human beings, and we already mentioned this in this interview, right? The complexity of the past, the complexity of human beings, the idea that historians are always looking for the causes of why things happen. They're not just interested in facts and dates and so forth and memorization, like some of you have maybe some of your listeners have nightmares from their high school history class, right, where they memorize all these things. But we're also thinking about, causation. Why do things happen the way they did? Another one of the C's is change over time. I always like to quote the historian Gordon Wood, who said that historians are always telling a story that begins with point A and ends with point B, and point B is always closer to the present. So it's historians who are, where we live and we work and we kind of have our being is between point A and B, right? And the kind of messiness of change as it happens over time. Then you have contingency, which is probably one of the more complicated of the C's, but the idea that every event is contingent upon another event, and history is not about these kind of macro sort of theological or philosophical systems that say, like fate or providence or something like that, but rather we as historians, by our vocation, by our calling as historians, we are talking about human experiences and the choices that human beings make. So there's a certain sense in which historians, even if they do believe in these larger macro philosophical systems, are always writing and talking and teaching about free will and actions and human actions. So I'm trying to think here. We got contingency, we got causation, change over time, complexity, and context, of course, context. Yeah, so, the era in which a particular event took place, context is always important for understanding any, interpreting any kind of human experience. So, I'm a big believer in the idea that these five C's are not just helpful in a history classroom or for those who like to read a lot of history or, those kinds of things. But these are the kind of skills that the study of the past teaches that are also applicable to our lives and the way we think about the world today. In an age of fake news, in an age where, we are being bombarded with so many different messages and we're not quite sure, what's true and what's not, I think these five C's, thinking in this way, can at least help us to make sense of the sort of cacophony of voices that we hear over and over again in our culture, and help us to make sense of how to process all of those voices.
It's a complex question, but it's also people in, culture, they treat it often as a very simplistic question. Was America founded as a Christian nation? I don't know how many people have come up to me or have said to me, friends, or acquaintances who've said at one point or another, well, if we could just get back to our Christian roots, right, as a beat, you know, we'd be okay. But it's really like, where does it begin, right? Was it the writing of the Constitution is when we became a nation? Was it the forming of the Continental Congress? For me, I like to think about it in terms of when the Massachusetts Bay Colony and the Jamestown colonies, right, as being an early beginning to the nation that we have today. But they were very different, right? It wasn't the guys who came to Jamestown had different hopes, dreams, goals, motivations than the families who came over and settled in Massachusetts and what is now today is Boston. Can you talk about the differences between Jamestown and Massachusetts Bay?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, just quickly to go back to the way you initially sort of began the question, you know, there's a lot of attempt at, I think a lot of the way in which history is used, particularly by Christians on the right who want America to be a Christian nation, is this sense of nostalgia, right? You know, we need to get back to this golden age that, you know, in some ways, you know, probably didn't exist in the way in which, you know, that golden age is being employed in our political debate today. One of the big questions that I tried to address, as you just brought up, is, you know, this question of when was America founded, right? And, you know, I tend to distinguish the kind of founding of the United States from the sort of planting of British colonies in the New World. I mean, in America, I mean, there's, you know, we're talking about 160 year separation between the so-called founding of the United States of America, if we were to date that, say, at 1776, and sort of the arrival of the first British settlers to establish a permanent settlement in Jamestown in 1607. Then you have New England Puritans or New England Separatists, Pilgrims, coming in 1620. And then a decade later, you have Puritans coming and creating the Massachusetts Bay Colony. So I think, you know, even if you were to say that America was somehow founded in the early 17th century, even then, there's no kind of unified way of thinking about that. The Jamestown colony, you know, and again, we have to be careful with this because I don't want to suggest that the Jamestown colony was completely secular. There were certainly, you know, archaeology and so forth has uncovered, you know, all kinds of things related to the religious life of the colony. But when we're thinking about the culture or the ethos of the Jamestown and early Virginia colony, the ethos is really not shaped by Christian faith as much as it is by economic motivations, even greed, the attempt to find gold. And if gold's not available, which the Virginia settlers quickly realized, then you need something to grow in what is often referred to as a mercantile economy that is going to, you know, be the same thing as gold. In other words, you need to get other nations to give up some of their gold in order to buy this good that they want. And that happens to be tobacco, the staple crop of tobacco. So I think tobacco is really what drives the Virginia colony. Very much self-interested, very much about economic acquisitiveness, gaining money, you know, so forth, mammon, so if you want to put it that way. And I think whatever religion exists there always sort of defers to that larger economic self-interested ethos. It's very different in New England, both the Plymouth colony founded in 1620, but also Massachusetts Bay founded in the 1630s, the so-called city on a hill, John Winthrop. These are clearly attempts to establish a Christian civilization, a Protestant civilization. If you want to break that down further, even a Calvinist Protestant civilization, in which the laws of the land are built upon biblical ideals, in which power in these societies is invested with people who have had conversion experiences. You know, this is one attempt at creating a Christian civilization. So you could technically make an argument that at the time of the planting in New England, you know, they were trying to create a Christian society. Then you have to, you also have to measure what kind of Christian society they were going to create. I mean, you could, you know, is it a particularly Christian society when you are basically hanging Quakers in Boston Common because they do not agree with your theological position that, you know, that sort of animates the life of the state? Does a Christian society do what it does to Native American populations in New England, you know, and so on and so forth. So even this early attempt in New England to create a Christian society, often, it does have some problems as well when you put what they're trying to do up against, say, the teachings of the Bible or the teachings of the Christian church. So it is, it's very complicated. And it's, you know, I often hear politicians who will say, back this, you know, when the pilgrims came over, they established the Christian nation. And it's just really, really bad. It's just really, really bad history. Now, again, were the pilgrims trying to create a Christian civilization? Yes. When a politician references the pilgrims and says they're trying to create a Christian society, they're right. But that's where the historical thinking skills come in, right? Because they don't consider the larger context, the complexity. The fact that change over time has taken place, you know, all of these things factor in.
I think it's interesting with Massachusetts Bay and the Pilgrims is that second, they had trouble with the second generation and third generation Puritans, because it's like, and it's classic story, right? The kids weren't as into it as the adults. Yeah. And you couldn't, and in order to be a voting member and a participating member in society and a church member, you had to profess a conversion experience. And the younger generations weren't able to do that. So then they had to modify what a conversion experience was and created like a half conversion experience. And
yeah.
It's like the kids are always ruining everything.
Yeah, right. The next generation is always worse. I mean, this is what historians call the declension model, the decline, right? I mean, there's one historian in the 1960s named Darrett Ruttman. I always quote him because I love his phrase. You know, he says that the Puritan, the pure Puritan utopian kind of city on a hill society was in a state of decline from the moment that the Puritan stepped off the boat in Boston. You know, I mean, it's very hard to sustain a society, this kind of society, when you also have this kind of really robust view, if you're a Puritan, of kind of human sin too. So, you know, there's some interesting scholarship on this. I mean, there's, you know, the famous Puritan Perry Miller, you know, made a similar argument to the one you just made. And I think it's largely correct, right? The halfway covenant, these attempts to kind of keep their special relationship with God. The Puritans believed that their society was a new Israel. And rather than using circumcision as the entrance into that special relationship with God, like the Israelites did, they saw infant baptism as their entrance in. So you still needed to be converted and saved in order to vote and in order to participate in government. But the covenant with God, the special relationship they had with God, you entered into that. That was sustained only by more and more people being baptized. The problem is you can't baptize your kid unless you yourself are saved and a church member, right? So fewer and fewer people are getting saved, which means fewer and fewer people are able to baptize their children, which means the covenant that is weakening. So you have to come up with some way to allow non-church members to still baptize their kids. And that becomes the halfway covenant. Now, there is some evidence to suggest, which is really interesting. There's a historian named Harry Stout, Miller's view. One of them is a Yale University historian named Harry Stout, who wrote a book called The New England Soul. And there he suggested that actually from the pulpits, the Sunday morning pulpits, the unpublished sermons that preachers preached, you still see this kind of covenant relationship with God that exists all the way up through the Reformation in Puritan New England. But it's in the sort of more public sermons that you see the decline. So even that gets a little messy and sort of complicated as historians kind of explore this a little bit more.
So why don't we move on a little bit in our chronology? Here's a question or a statement that people say, well, all the founders were Christians.
Yeah. Again, it's a little more complicated than that. Again, it depends how you define Christianity. You have someone like, say, Thomas Jefferson, who rejected a belief in the resurrection of Jesus Christ, rejected the belief that Jesus Christ was God, rejected the idea that the Bible was inspired. For me, it's hard to mesh that with sort of those beliefs with sort of traditional Christianity. Jefferson always believed he was somewhat of a Christian, but clearly his core beliefs were not in line with historic Orthodox Christianity. You could make the same case for someone like Ben Franklin or John Adams, John Adams, who rejected the Christian doctrine of the Trinity. A lot of these founding fathers would have rejected core Christian beliefs. There were others, people like John Witherspoon, who was the only minister to sign the Declaration of Independence, president of Princeton University, or known then as the College of New Jersey. You have people like Samuel Adams. You have Patrick Henry, John Jay. These people, would probably identify with even today modern evangelicals in their Orthodox Christian beliefs. So again, I always tell my students, especially when you're talking about religion, be careful of lumping all the founding fathers together and saying the founding fathers all believed this. They were all deists, or they were all atheists, or they were all Christians, or they were all secular, because they vary from person to person. Now, another important point to make is just because we tend to equate the personal beliefs of the founding fathers with their views on the role that religion should play in society. And what I mean by that is, let's take somebody like John Adams, for example. John Adams despised the Calvinists of the Puritan New England that were his ancestors. He just thought that they were, they took the Bible too literally. They were far too dogmatic in their beliefs. He rejected the Trinity. So he was, by the end of his life, he was a Unitarian. But John Adams also firmly believed that government money, tax money, should go to pay in Massachusetts for an established church, the Congregational Church, because he believed that Christianity especially, was absolutely essential to helping create a moral order in society. Thomas Jefferson believed something along these lines. So did Benjamin Franklin, despite the fact that they themselves would have rejected Orthodox Christian beliefs. You have to remember that the founding fathers were not theologians. They weren't pastors. They weren't missionaries, right? Their purpose was to build a republic. And if religious belief could help them build a strong and moral and virtuous, as they would have described it, republic, then they would find it useful. I like to say, if there was some kind of religion that did not provide a foundation for a good moral republic, perhaps a religious form of Christianity that was prophetic or criticized the republic, I'm not sure the founding fathers would have had much use for that kind of religion, because they were really not, thought about religion in a kind of utilitarian sense in terms of public religion. Now, again, they all had their own individual convictions.
So when we think about founding documents, the Declaration of Independence mentions God, but the Constitution does not. A big argument that comes up from time to time is whether the First Amendment of the Constitution gives us freedom of religion or freedom from religion. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of a religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. It's used by both sides, right?
Yeah, yeah. The First Amendment is, you know, my take on this is that the First Amendment is it doesn't give us a lot of guidance when it comes to all of these contemporary questions that we debate on in the culture wars today. We've had to rely upon the courts over the years, especially in the 20th century, to interpret what the First Amendment means. But, you know, in its historical context, the First Amendment, and this is why I'm somewhat of a little bit of an opponent of this idea of original intent, because, you know, we could say, as far as we know about the original intent of the authors of the First Amendment, James Madison and others, they were opposed to a religious establishment. There will be no state church, right? No religion will have privilege over other religions. And then they said that, you know, people are allowed to exercise their religion freely without government interference. Now, that does not necessarily help us that much in terms of understanding what to do when there's the Ten Commandments display in the courthouse. Should that or shouldn't that be there? Or whether you can have a manger scene during Christmas on public land, or whether you can have prayer at a football game. The First Amendment just really isn't clear as to what that means. So it's been the courts who have interpreted this for us. I think the most significant court case on the First Amendment came in 1947, the so-called Everson versus Board of Education case, in which I won't go into the details of the case, but in that case, Justice Hugo Black coined the famous phrase that there is a wall of separation between church and state, and that wall of separation should be high and impregnable. Now, that court case, to some extent, was applied in 1962 and 1963 when prayer and Bible reading, mandatory prayer and Bible reading, were removed from public schools, and it's been applied in multiple other cases since then. So, you know, the Supreme Court in 1947 applied the 14th Amendment to church-state issues, interpreted the First Amendment through the 14th Amendment, and concluded that there is a separation of church and state. Now, you know, there are some, I think, legitimate conservative scholars who argue that that was wrongly decided. There's a lot of also crazy conservative scholars who don't really understand the context at all. But there's a lot of good conservative scholars who would say, the 1947 Everson case was based upon the 1802 letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote to a group of Baptists in Danbury, Connecticut, in which he said that, you know, there is a wall of separation between church and state. And it really doesn't, it's not a really an interpretation of the First Amendment. It's an interpretation of that letter. So this gets into, again, a bunch of different debates, huge debates over this. But if we were to abide by the Supreme Court ruling in 1947, which is still sort of on the books and still operates as sort of the definitive case in separation of church and state issues, then this has been largely decided, and it is it's hard to say that religious symbols and so forth should be present in public spaces. You know, originally the First Amendment was designed to protect the church, not the state, right? So the church, we're going to keep government out of the church to protect the purity of the church so that the church can do what it does without government interference. And that's in some ways the way Protestants have always understood it. So in the 1947 case, evangelical Protestants were strongly in favor and in support of the Everson decision, the wall of separation, because the case was about government funding to Catholic schools who wanted the state, the government, to pay for their busing. And the Protestants didn't like the Catholics, so they said, we can't be funding Catholics. This is a Protestant country. So when the Supreme Court said that there was a separation between church and state, and that is high and impregnable, the Protestants said, you better believe that's true. Right? We affirm separation of church and state because we don't want money going to Catholics. Of course, this would come back to haunt evangelicals in 62 and 63 with the prayer and Bible reading cases when it was applied against them. So, you know, again, it gets very messy.
Yeah, that Catholic versus Protestant, I mean, that's a whole episode in itself. I've actually been consciously staying away from the Catholic questions because we don't have that kind of time. You know, I wish we had 17 hours. Right. Like, it'd be great. Let's move on to the Civil War briefly. This summer, I read Mark Knoll's book, Civil War is Theological Crisis.
Excellent book.
Excellent book. Everyone should read it. Your book kind of says, you know, yeah, it was the Civil War was about deciding which kind of Christian nation we would be.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't obviously entirely about that. I think the Civil War was really about the issue of slavery, but slavery was wed. This Christian nation question is wed and bound up with this whole question of slavery. I think the North, in the Civil War, you know, we tend to think, you know, immediately say, you know, I asked my students, why do you think the North thought they were a Christian nation? And most of my students will respond right away, because they opposed slavery, right? And that eventually is what happened. Once the war became a war about slavery, you know, the North began to claim, well, God must be on our side because we're fighting against this evil institution. But earlier in the war, and really you see this carrying on throughout the course of the war, one of the reasons as well that the North thought that God was on their side was because of this idea of the Union, this idea that somehow the Constitution and the creation of the Constitution and the establishment of a very strong federal government was a kind of divine event. It was God kind of endorsing the sacredness of the Union. And thus, anyone who was going to challenge the sacredness of this solid, right, union that was created in 1787 and ratified in 1789 by all the states, anyone who challenges this then, you know, is sort of challenging the will of God, challenging God's sort of special relationship with the United States. Now, the South, on the other hand, you know, they argued that America, or I should say the Confederacy, was a Christian nation because they were following the teachings of the Bible on the issue of slavery. So you have this sort of strange argument, but, you know, it's at least strange in terms of our present day, that the South and the Confederacy is being more Christian and is more aligned with the will of God because the Bible does not condemn slavery and we uphold slavery, right? So we are more Christian because we have slaves. You know, there's this wonderful moment in the, this is not wonderful, historically wonderful, but there's this moment when they're writing the Confederate Constitution and they add these words in there, you know, Almighty God. In other words, they defer to Almighty God in the preamble of the Confederate Constitution. And the Confederates are quick to note that we put God in our Constitution, while the North does not have God in their Constitution. So this is a clear sign that God is going to be on our side in the war. This bothered Northern preachers, especially, you know, this argument that the South made. This bothered them so much that they tried to actually start an organization called the National Reform Association, I always say it's the NRA before the actual NRA, the gun NRA. And the whole purpose of the National Reform Association was to add a Christian amendment to the United States Constitution to say that we are a Christian nation. And it was born directly out of many ministers who were upset that why did the Confederate Constitution have God in it, but we don't, right? So in some ways, yes, Noel is right. I agree with Noel on this, that these debates over slavery and states' rights were very much tied into the idea of, you know, who was on God's side, right? And thus Lincoln comes in his second inaugural address in March of 1865 and says, you know, both sides pray to the same God, right? Both sides invoke the Bible and claim to have divine authority. But then in that wonderful phrase, Lincoln says, but the Almighty has his own purposes, right? Appealing to the kind of mystery of God, appealing to the kind of verse we read in, say, 1 Corinthians 13:12 in the Bible, right? We see through a glass dimly. We don't know what God is doing, so don't try to invoke him to justify your cause. And then Lincoln has this wonderful argument where he says, you know, our hands are all dirty. We're all soiled. Our hands are all soiled from slavery. 250 years of unrequited toil, you know, is his word. So let's not judge, lest ye be judged. There's so much rich biblical imagery in that second inaugural address.
And in another Mark Noel book, The History of Christianity in America.
United States and Canada. Yeah.
Yes,
good book.
Great book. And he kind of touches on how Lincoln had made this tremendous spiritual growth throughout the period of the Civil War, how he personally, his personal faith, his personal relationship with God just grew, and how he really came to lean on God and prayed to God to understand his role in the great national conflict.
I think that's a good point. I do think that Lincoln, I think Noel would agree with me when I say that Lincoln never really embraces Christianity, never really embraces the idea that this God incarnated himself in the form of a human being and died on the cross for man's sins. But certainly he sees this God as an active force, his God is an active force in world affairs and politics and so forth. And I think Noel is right when he suggests that, you know, Lincoln leans upon that God, especially later in his life.
So you've been so gracious with your time, but I can't let you go without talking about, believe me, the evangelical road to Donald Trump. It kind of, this conversation leads to this road, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think what I'm trying to get at in this book, it'll be out later in the late spring. And what I'm doing is I'm trying to approach the 2016 election and the rise of Donald Trump as a historian, and to ask, what is it about the history of American evangelicals that led 81% of them to vote for Donald Trump? So that is the crux of sort of what I'm trying to unpack. And so there's a lot of history in the book. I would not be telling the truth if I said that the book, unlike any other book that I've written, my five previous books, I'd be saying this book is a little bit different, because I do kind of speak as well as an evangelical Christian who is trying to sort of call my fellow evangelicals to think a little more deeply about their relationship to Donald Trump. But the book is largely sort of a history book, but it does have a little bit of a sort of political angle to it. What I'm trying to understand is, the way evangelicals have thought about politics in the last 8 years and 10 years, the last 50 years, the last even 200 or 300 years, and trying to think about the way in which fear and power and nostalgia, I mentioned this before, those three things have really driven the way evangelicals have approached political life, and in many ways drove them straight into the arms of, of Donald Trump. So I don't want to tip my hand too much. The book will be out again in June. I would suggest, you know, I'm often blogging about the things in my book. If people want to check out my blog at thewayofimprovement.com. And get out there and pre-order a copy of it too. Go down to Amazon and buy yourself a copy in advance.
I will do that today. And please plug your Twitter handle, because I love following you on Twitter. What is that?
Sure. Yeah, sure. My handle is at John, JohnFea1, JohnFea1. I'm mostly trying to bring some historical perspective to contemporary events, but I wouldn't be telling the truth if I also didn't, sort of get political and so forth. But, I'm trying to think as a Christian, I'm trying to think Christianly about, the world, about the past, about the relationship between the past and the present, about politics and so forth. So, I'd love it if you could follow me and see what we're doing on Twitter.
So one last question for you, and I'll try to make it brief. When Trump was elected, we were all shocked by it. I imagined at this point we would have two Republican parties and a Democratic Party. We would have there would be a split, and it's not happened. I mean, even the ones who have had somewhat profiles and courage, Bob Corker and Jeff Flake, they make speeches, they make statements, but they have, and in fact, in the past couple of weeks, really fallen in line. Everyone, it is now the party of Trump. What about evangelicals? I mean, what is going to happen to the church, or what do you see happening to the church?
Yeah. Well, I think your assessment is correct. I think when you really when you really get down to it, most Republicans on issues of policy agree with most of what Trump's doing. Now, you're going to have debates over the wall, and you're going to have debates over immigration, but in terms of tax cuts and moral issues, social, abortion and those kinds of things, most Republicans are going to be on board with Trump. You know, Mike, I have a concern about the way evangelicals are responding to Trump. Now, again, 81% of American evangelicals voted for Donald Trump. That's a complicated number in the sense that, not all evangelicals voted for Donald Trump because they like Donald Trump, or that they tolerate him, or, I'm sure some have maybe had regrets about voting for Donald Trump. But there is a hardcore evangelical group. They're led by people like Robert Jeffress, the pastor of the First Baptist Church of Dallas, Jerry Falwell Jr., the president of Liberty University, and others. I call them the court evangelical.
Yes,
because they
do.
Like to show up.
Yes, you do.
They like to show up every now and then at the king's court and flatter him without speaking truth to power. You know, I think there's this hard-line group of people. Tony Perkins has recently come out. We're talking here in January of 2018. So Tony Perkins recently said that he wanted to give Donald Trump a mulligan, as he put it, for his relationship with a porn star that happened 10 or 11, 12 years ago.
But John, who else gets the mulligan? Who else gets the mulligan?
Yeah.
I mean, would Barack Obama have gotten the mulligan? Did Bill Clinton get a mulligan? I mean, he did politically.
This is the sort of kind of hypocrisy that I see in this hardline group of evangelicals. One of the things that I've traced on my blog, but I also will talk about in the Believe Me book, is the way in which many of these exact same people had back in the 1990s said that Bill Clinton was incapable of being president because of his immoral character. But yet they give Trump a pass. So what I worry about as an evangelical is the way in which the witness of evangelicals in the world. I mean, if you're an evangelical, one of the things that you hold dear is your ability to share your faith with other people. And to have that opportunity to do that, to share the so-called good news of the gospel. And it's become, we're beginning to see more and more examples of, say, missionaries saying it's much harder to do our work with Trump in charge, making all these statements about people from Africa and El Salvador and Haiti. It's becoming more and more difficult for evangelicals to, to share their faith, you know, with other people in regular conversation, because you always now have to have this initial step where you say, the other person says, well, are you a Trump supporter? And that's going to hurt your cause. So I think Trump ultimately is going to hurt in the long run the witness of the gospel. And I think when evangelicals turn towards power and they turn towards this kind of power politics, they want to be in control, they want to pass their views on other people and make other people conform to their views, this kind of political power does not mesh very well with a suffering Savior who died on the cross in an incredible political act, ushering in a new kind of kingdom, right? He dies to usher in a kingdom. This is not what Christianity is all about. I've been recently reading, I've been teaching a class at my church on politics, and I was recently reading a great book by a University of Virginia sociologist, you may be familiar with him, James Davison Hunter. And the book is called To Change the World. And what Hunter has this incredible line, I posted it on my blog, you can go on the blog, the last couple of days I posted it, in which he said, when Christians pursue political power, right, and try to win the culture through politics, it's going to lead to quote-unquote bizarre turns in who they're going to sort of get into bed with, and it's ultimately going to hurt the cause of Christianity in the world. But it's fascinating. Hunter wrote this in 2010. He talks about Christians pursuing power and the bizarre turns that happen, you know, when this takes place. If there's anything that hasn't been more bizarre, is Christians, evangelical Christians, supporting a man like Donald Trump. At least that's the way I look at it.
Thank you so much, John Fea. You've been so gracious with your time. The books are Was America Founded as a Christian Nation? And Believe Me, The Evangelical Road to Donald Trump.
Thank you for listening to The Road to Now. If you enjoyed this episode, please help us spread the word. Text a link to a friend, share a link on social media, or take a minute to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. All of this helps us spread the word about our show. So if you've already done that, thank you. Speaking of thank you, now's the time where we say the special shout out to our supporters on Patreon, with particular emphasis on our Washingtonians. Thank you to Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Big White, Peggy Donica, Matt Williams, Team Martin, Ann Williams and Frank Edwards, and Daniel Hansen. To all of you, we are grateful. If you're enjoying what you hear on The Road to Now, you can join us there on Patreon too. Just go to patreon.com/theroadtonow. There are extra episodes, bonus materials, and you can even join us for an upcoming trivia night or live recordings. That's patreon.com/theroadtonow. Our patrons keep us going. For more on this episode and our podcast in general, please visit our website, www.theroadtonow.com, where you can easily search our back catalog and quickly find links to content. You're going to be amazed by that website. And you want to know why? Because it was designed by Charles and Destiny at Seven Ages Design. Go check those guys out. They made our lives a lot easier and made us look a lot better. The Road to Now is hosted and produced by Bob Crawford and me, Ben Sawyer. Our associate producer is Gary Fletcher. Our theme music is by Paul DeFiglia. For Bob Crawford, this is Ben Sawyer. Thank you for listening. Take care.